Hey, I know what'll cheer you up.
Welcome to the Bright Ideas Podcast, where we let proven experts help you to find the next bright idea to implement in your business today. And now, here's your host, Trent Deersmith.
This is unbelievable. This true force has never been fully understood.
Hey there, Bright Idea Hunters. Welcome back to episode number 137 of the Bright Ideas Podcast. I am your host, Trent Deersmith, and this is the podcast where we help entrepreneurs to discover ways to use digital marketing and marketing automation to dramatically increase the growth of their business. If you're an entrepreneur looking for proven tactics and strategies to help you increase traffic to your website, to capture more leads, and to ultimately attract more customers, well, guess what? You are in the right place. So how do I do that? Well, I bring proven experts onto the show with me to share with you the exact tactics and strategies that they used to build their business into the success that it is today. No theories here, folks. Only proven stuff from people who are in the trenches, elbow deep, just like you and me. This episode, my guest is a fellow by the name of Nathan Urien, and he is a co-founder of a marketing agency called Adhere Creative. Three guys started it at the kitchen table and is now a seven-figure a year and growing content marketing agency with a nice roster of clients, all happily paying those glorious monthly retainers. So if you want to learn how to build an agency like that, this is a great interview for you to listen to, because in it, we're going to talk about in detail Nathan's strategy for how they attract leads. There's actually three different ways that we talk about that they do it. One of those ways is content marketing. And I've asked him quite a number of specific questions about how does he make sure that he gets the right content promoted in the right way so that it gets read by the right people. Kind of important, huh? Because it's no use creating content for the wrong audience and not promoting it, because then it never gets read. You don't capture any leads. And so that's no good at all. We're also going to talk about how they're syndicating their content. We're going to talk about the type of conversation they have when a lead becomes sales qualified. And let me tell you this, they get them on retainer almost all the time, right from day one. And there's some very specific reasons why Nathan and his team have taken this approach to onboarding a new customer. So you'll want to listen and get those details, because I'll tell you that I'm going to be changing my strategy ever so slightly as a result of what I learned from Nathan in this interview. There's also a very cool little Twitter trick that I learned that I'm going to be incorporating into my content promotion strategy. It involves hashtags, and all of the details are in the episode. So in just a moment, we're going to welcome Nathan to the show. Before we do that, I want to give you a very quick announcement. I am frequently emailed by people saying, "Hey, Trent, what tools do you use in your business to make it go?" And so I have a list of all those tools. You can get them at grabtrentsbonus.com. Some of them are affiliate links. And that means that if you click those links and buy those pieces of software, I get paid a little affiliate commission by the people that make that software. And when you do that, you have my thanks, but you also have more than my thanks. You get some free stuff. That's why the link is called grabtrentsbonus.com. There are bonuses there, and there's explanations on how you can get those bonuses. So as soon as you've made your purchase of whatever it is that you're using, you send in your receipt to the right place, and you get your choice of some of the free things. Well, they're not free. I sell them, but you get them for free, because I want to thank you for using my affiliate links. All right, with that PSA announcement out of the way, guess what? It's time to get the show rolling. So please join me in welcoming Nathan to the show. Hey, Nathan, welcome to the show.
Hey, Trent, thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. It's my pleasure to have you here. So as I always do, I want to give you the opportunity to introduce yourself and set the stage for the discussion that we're about to have about the successful agency that you are in the process of growing. And we're going to dive in, as I always do, into all the nitty-gritty and get as much information out of you as I can for my audience on what's working for you in terms of how you're growing that agency. So lots of details to come, folks. But before we do that, Nathan, please take a moment and just tell us who you are and what you do.
Sure, absolutely. My name is Nathan Urien. I'm the president and director of strategy of Adhere Creative. It's an inbound marketing agency located in Houston, Texas.
Cool. So what type of customer, and you said the name quite quickly, so I want to have you say it again. It's Adhere Creative, right?
Exactly.
Okay. An interesting name, first of all, before we move on to anything. Why'd you pick Adhere? I can sort of figure it out, but I don't want to guess wrong.
Sure. When we initially started, we were very heavy in branding and brand development. And what we really wanted was to create brands that were memorable or that stuck out in the marketplace and really stuck in people's minds. And that's where the word or concept Adhere came from. We wanted brands that adhered to customers or potential customers' memories, basically. And that's where the root of Adhere Creative came from.
Okay. And so you started back in 2010. Was it the beginning of 2010?
Exactly, beginning of 2010.
Okay. And was it just you or was it you and a co-founder?
It was myself and two other co-founders.
Okay.
Really just starting up in my dining room, a couple desks in there, trying to make a go of it.
And how much did you guys do in that first year?
The first year, I'd say, there was a lot of learning, a lot of setup time, but as far as actual revenue, I'd say we probably did about maybe $150,000, somewhere in that range.
Okay. And so was that enough for, did you guys come into this with a pile of savings to see you through, or was that enough for you to all pay your bills for that first year?
No, we all came into it with a pile of savings. All had kind of the entrepreneurial itch and really knew what it was going to take, how long it was going to take to get startup and have a plan to get to that next level where we would actually be able to pay ourselves appropriate salaries. So we definitely came into it, each of us with a bankroll and prepared to make the sacrifice of not necessarily having that safety blanket of a salary to begin with.
All right. So you mean you didn't go onto the Warrior Forum and buy a course for $7 that said you'd be rich in 35 days as long as you worked hard?
I tried that first and it didn't work, so this is plan B.
Did you seriously?
No.
I bring that up because it saddens me to see how many people sell that crap, and even worse, how many people are tricked into buying it. It's just absolutely horrible.
Well, it's really, from my perspective, that thing when I see those get rich quick anything, it's really, to me, it's annoying and it's, in my opinion, disrespectful of people in general. It's just feeding on what I would consider the most desperate, the ones who actually want to start and start quick, might be the person that's actually in need of that type of income in a very fast manner. And unfortunately, 99% of those types of quote unquote opportunities are nothing more than a get rich quick scheme for whoever the founder of that particular entity is. There's really usually no opportunity for anyone to really start and grow in those types of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, boy, I could rant on this for a while, but I won't. We'll move on. All right. In the last 12 months, you think you told me you did just north of $1 million in revenues. Have I got that right?
Yes.
Okay. So from progress in 4 years for a couple of guys at the kitchen table with no venture-backed funding and a vision for what they wanted to create, by all accounts, I would say that you guys have been wildly successful. So now let's dive into how did you make it all happen? Because that's the question that I get asked more than any by the people in my audience is, Trent, how do I get started? How do I get those first couple of customers? And then I get another group of people are saying, I got customers, but I'm dying. I'm working. I'm a solo and I'm just dying. I work way too much and I'm not making enough money. So hopefully in this interview, we can address the needs of both of those people and entrepreneurs from other walks of life that may have needs that I'm not even aware of. But anyway, so back at the beginning, what was your background before you and your two partners decided that, hey, we're going to go into business for ourselves and we're going to launch a marketing agency?
Sure. I've always been very interested in marketing, very interested in selling and advertising. And that whole realm of things has always interested me from the time I was a child wanting to set up, lemonade stands or making some sort of craft that I could sell to someone or always producing and marketing something. When it was time to actually choose a profession in school, it was it was a pretty easy selection. Marketing and advertising was definitely my passion, so that's what I ended up following. While I was in school, I had the opportunity to work for a large commercial HVAC company here in Houston. They do large contracts like Reliant Stadium and really large things, not like home air conditioning or something like that. And they really had never done any marketing. So I knew the president. He knew kind of my background and what I was interested in, what I was studying, kind of brought me in and said, hey, we've never really done any of this. We'd like for you to craft a program and then kind of lead the marketing charge for us. So that was my first real exposure to be able to do what we do now every day. Once I graduated, I tried my hand in the business-to-business sales for a while. There's a local company here that sells commercial office furniture to large corporations, you know, an office that going to be filled maybe 3-4 floors. You go in, do all of the cubicles, all of the conference rooms, all of the desks, all of those things. And was doing that for a while. And it just, I liked the sales thing. I liked who I was working with. In general, the company was great, but it wasn't really my passion. I wasn't really able to get in there and alter the messaging or alter the marketing to produce more success than I was really capable of as a single individual salesperson.
But you could sell them a cool desk.
Say that one more time?
I say, but you could sell them a cool desk.
I could sell them a cool desk. I had a cool desk. It wasn't what I was passionate about. And I sat there and thought to myself, what if you're doing this when you're 60 years old? Are you going to be happy? And the answer was absolutely not. So, that's really what the motivation was. I've had experienced the joy of creating that marketing plan and experienced the joy when that marketing plan actually produces success for a company. And really wanted to get back to that. Conveniently, at the same time, I had a gentleman I went to school with had just sold his company, and he was kind of looking for the what's next venture, a gentleman that I had worked with a few years prior to that, was a great graphic designer, was really wanting to get out on his own and do his own company. So we kind of came together and said, how can we make this work? What does this look like? What are we going to do? And that's how we started.
And so the first couple clients, did they come from personal outreach, existing relationships, referrals, content marketing? Where'd they come from?
The first few clients came from the existing relationships. All of the partners knew people from the sales and marketing side of things, new company owners, and it really came from the relationships that we already had with them. They knew us, they trusted us, they had a need, but they had some more trust in that they could take it to. And that's really how we got our first few clients.
And so many clients later, has the type of client that you are trying to attract, has it changed much from those first few clients that you got?
Absolutely. The first few clients, I mean, at that stage in the game, it's anyone that has money, what are we going to do for them? You know, it's still trying to figure out what you really want to offer. Even if you've mapped it all out, you don't have it perfect. So getting in there and providing the services to the customer, you're able to kind of figure out, one, what you want to do, and two, what you're good at doing. So, you know, those first few customers are probably even the first year. There was a lot of figuring out what it is we actually want to be doing. So although our first few customers are great, a lot of them are still with us. We've realigned and refocused on what I would consider companies in growth mode. Not necessarily they just want a website, or they need help with a trade show booth, or they need help putting a email campaign together. Really, what we focused on is businesses, companies that really want almost an outsourced marketing department, want someone to come in and create a solid plan around their product and their customer and how to go to market with it. And then do the marketing activities to actually deliver that service or that product to the prospective customers in the best light. So the majority of our clients right now are on a monthly retainer base where we operate as their outsourced marketing department on everything from consulting to pricing to go-to-market strategies. Obviously, we still handle all of the design elements, the content elements, the development elements, but it's gotten bigger than that where we're really helping them shape the direction, future direction of not only the marketing message, but the delivery vehicles of that message.
Okay, so there's a couple of questions I want to ask to follow up on that. One of them, which is not going to be the first question, so don't answer this yet. I just want the audience to know where we're going, is, you know, how do you attract those kind of leads? And then what is the engagement conversation look like? So I'll go into more detail on that in just a moment. And then, of course, now that I've done that, I went and forgot what other. Oh, yeah. Here's the other thing I wanted to ask before that is, can you just loosely describe, or not even loosely, specifically describe, when you mentioned retainer, when you have a client on retainer, how are they holding you accountable? Is it a retainer that's based on like a block of time each month, or is it a retainer based upon the achievement of certain measurable goals?
The quick answer to that question is both. So the actual quantifiable component of the retainer is a set amount of time within a given month and general set amount of activities that are going to happen within that time. Now, that said, the plan that we're going to create for each individual company is it's going to be different because all companies are different, but it will have different checks and balances and different metrics that we're going to be measuring to gauge success. So some of them are going to be website traffic. Some of them are going to be the amount of sales leads that they're actually generating. Or if we're really integrated into the marketing and sales process of a company, it can even be as granular as actual sales that are coming from the marketing activities.
Interesting. The interview that I did earlier today, they didn't want to be the agency, and I understand why. They didn't want to be held accountable on the number of sales that were closed because that was beyond what they touched. He says, I don't train or have any control over my client's sales team. So for us to be held accountable for how well that sales team does or doesn't close leads that we've produced for them isn't something that I want to be exposed to. So how have you dealt with that? Are you just...
Well, again, that goes back to how intermingled we are in their actual processes in general. Mm-hmm. When I say that, there's a delicate relationship between the marketing of a company and the sales of a company. If they're not properly integrated, there's no way to really get that accountability. And a lot of agencies will step away from that and say, we can't be responsible for your sales team's inefficiency to close a deal. And of course, the sales team is going to say, well, the leads you're giving us are no good. So it's kind of a back and forth between those two groups. In reality, as long as you connect them with the proper components, as long as sales tells you what makes a proper lead, and as long as you have technologies in place to source and grade those leads effectively so that every lead that you're giving them is a quality lead. But on their side as well, there has to be a dedicated sales process that they go through with these qualified leads, and not just the ones that marketing delivers, but the ones they come upon themselves, so that they're always going through the same process, so that as these things are closing or not closing, that information can also go back to marketing. So we can say, you know what, we have 5 salespeople over there, 4 of them close 80% of leads we give them. 1 closes 20%. And we need to see what they're doing differently. And if they have the proper sales systems in place, you'll easily be able to see that. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, if we're using, for simplicity's sake, 2 different channels to generate these leads, and we notice that 80% of the leads that come from one of the channels, let's say it's a blog, close. But another channel that we have, maybe a newsletter, only 20% of the leads from the newsletter close. Those are our data points that we can then look at and realign our strategies to maximize the leads that are coming to that sales, so the qualified leads that are coming to that sales team to begin with. So it is possible to get in there And I wouldn't say take responsibility for the sales team, but I would say take responsibility for the ability to maximize their success. So going in there, helping them craft a plan, helping them put the technologies in place so that marketing and sales can truly work together as one unit rather than two separate units that are constantly blaming each other for the shortcomings.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. The type of client that you deal with, is there a certain revenue size that you want to make sure you don't dip below? Let me preface that by saying, what is the amount of your average monthly retainer?
Average monthly retainer is probably in the neighborhood of about 5,000.
Okay. So what size companies do you need to target to make it relatively easy to get them to pay a $5,000 a month retainer?
I wouldn't say that it has as much to do with their revenue. It has more to do with the potential margin on an individual sale. So if we look at each opportunity as an isolated incident, the amount of activity, marketing activities, and dollars that would be spent on that one particular closing of the sale, does that make sense? So, for instance, we're selling cheeseburgers, let's say, and we have, you know, a dollar margin on every cheeseburger that we sell. That's not going to make sense because we're going to end up spending more in marketing than you're ever going to generate through that one cheeseburger that got sold. Even if they bring their girlfriend, they end up with two cheeseburgers. Our clients generally are going to have a higher sales ticket. So it might be a SaaS software-based company that has a recurring contract. So it isn't just one sale. It's one sale every month for the life of that contract. So they have a longer customer lifetime value. It could be a big-ticket item like an industrial company that sells piping equipment, that when they close a deal, it's generally $250,000, and $80,000 might be the profit on that one particular deal. So those are generally the types of customers that best fit with what we do. Mm-hmm. There are a few exceptions that can fit into it, that fit sometimes in the nonprofit space where it isn't really about a transaction per se, but it's more about exposure. To try and generate donations. But again, the donation itself is at least the target would be a more sizable type donation.
Okay. So now let's make good on that promise I made the audience a few minutes ago to talk about the lead generation and the sales conversation. So you have a fairly specific set of criteria that would make up your ideal type of customer that you're trying to attract, which you just described. What are the ways that are working best for you to generate those kind of leads?
I would say the two ways, let me step back. The three ways that I would say are best are referrals from existing customers. When we do a great job for our customers and they really start to see the benefit of what's happening, they talk about it. When they talk about it, they're generally talking about it to their friends who probably are in a similar situation as they are. We get a lot of company owners, executives that we deal with that end up talking to other company owners, other executives that call us up and say, hey, I was talking to so-and-so, and they were telling me about what you were doing. I want to see what you can do for me. Mm-hmm. That's very, very common for us.
Let me interrupt you there for a moment. Do you ask these people to refer you out, or are they just doing it all on their own without you having to do or say anything?
They're actually doing it all on their own. Okay. We don't ask them to refer us business. If they're happy enough with what we're doing, they'll do it naturally, I think.
Okay. So that was number one, referrals. What's number two?
We've had fairly good success with partners. When I say partners, people that are also working with similar types of companies. To give you an example, we have a really good relationship with a Salesforce consulting firm here in Houston, and they have a lot of clients that have marketing issues. They have the sales side down. They're getting their Salesforce piece customized, but they don't have the marketing side down. They're not delivering the correct leads into the Salesforce system. So again, back to that marketing and sales alignment piece, we're able to step in a lot of times and realign that marketing piece so they get the maximum value out of not only their marketing, but also their sales and maximum use of Salesforce product. And vice versa, when we're working on the marketing side and we need to get that alignment going, we'll bring that consulting firm in to those opportunities as well. So there's a really good symbiotic relationship. There's also a few softwares that we work with, marketing softwares that we work with, one of them being HubSpot, that a lot of clients that we talk to out there will end up bringing them to the HubSpot platform because it really helps us see all of the different marketing metrics and have all the marketing tools in one centralized location, which maximizes our time as a marketing company and then as a result the benefit to the company. But HubSpot itself has this giant marketing machine. When people come to HubSpot and say, we're interested in ABC, who do you think we should go to for this? HubSpot keeps tabs on what agencies do what specific things best. And they'll try and match those customers to the agencies that they know can take care of them. So we've been able to obviously give business to HubSpot, but also get business as well.
Okay, so let me go back to the Salesforce consulting company. How did you create that relationship?
To be perfectly honest, we were looking for a very specific solution to a very complex problem within Salesforce, and we had pretty much called Salesforce and said, "We need your help. We need to get this thing done. We need to get it done ASAP. Who do you recommend?" And they recommended this group, and I mean it's been great working with them, and they're truly professional. They've never said that can't be done. It's always possible and always works well, which is kind of the same philosophy that our agency has, which anything can be done. It's a matter of how it's going to be done. So that's how it came to be, and that's definitely a great relationship for us.
Okay. So number one, referrals. Number two, partners. What's number three? Because you mentioned there was three.
Number three would be our own content that we put out. Our content is a huge driver of our sales leads. People are out there and consuming our ebooks or our blogs or our guest posts or our podcast that we do and are able to really see the value of what we have in the services that we offer. And a lot of times we'll reach out sometimes it's, hey, we need help with our complete marketing scenario. Sometimes it's, we just need this one thing from you. The people that need that one thing, it's usually a self-diagnosis of some type, but they're able to read a blog article about how to maximize the benefits of call to action by using A/B testing so you can see which ad copy or which call to action color or button is actually going to perform best over time, and then really using that to maximize their lead conversions. And then they'll call up or send in an email or fill out a form and say, we really need help with our call to action buttons. And we'll take a look at their call to action buttons and look at the overall strategy of where their call to action buttons are leading, what are the actions that happen after the call to action button is clicked on. Is there a landing page? Can they fill out a form? Are they being sent to a phone number? Is there value in the offer that's being shown to this prospective customer? And then once they complete or convert, what happens now? Does it just go to a salesperson? Does it get put into some sort of nurturing program? Is that person a qualified candidate? And we'll dive into a lot of these things. And sometimes their marketing programs are very well designed, and truly what they need is just a review of their calls to action. Mm-hmm. More times than not, they're lacking some of the strategy pieces and some of the marketing components to really maximize their success. And we can kind of bring in a consultation and say, this is what you should really be focusing on, and this is why. And a lot of times those are the ones that will say, you know what, you're absolutely right, I see the value. Let's start small, and then let's grow into a bigger relationship.
All right. What I'm curious about knowing is, and I think this is a challenge for anyone and everyone who's a content marketer, How do you promote your content? Because, you know, we all define our buyer personas and we write to those buyer personas for a specific piece of content. But if you don't promote it anywhere, you know, no one's going to see it. How do you promote your content in a way so as that it gets read by the person you were writing for? And you can use a specific example if you'd like. I'd be better, actually, if you could use a specific example.
Sure. Well, each piece of content has to be meticulously planned. So you mentioned buyer personas. When you outline who exactly you're talking to, what they care about, what they're looking for, and then step back and say, okay, how can I help that person, that particular person in their job or their particular situation, what value can I truly offer that person? So as long as you start from the point of view of my goal is to offer help, you're almost always going to be able to frame your, let's say it's a blog article, for example, you're almost always going to be able to frame your title and your outline and your content in general to be aimed at a very specific person. So let's say you were to write three things medical marketers aren't doing but should be. Well, the only person that's actually going to read that is a medical marketer. It is directly aimed at that particular person. And that might be an oversimplification, but there's times and places where you can direct it at very specific individuals in very specific instances. And then you have to strategically plan how you're going to deliver that content. Just creating it and having the right keywords and the right topics within the post is fine, and people will find that and gravitate toward it as they come across it online. But you have to be more strategic than that. You have to think, if it is about this medical marketing component, you're really talking to the medical marketer, whether it be a competing agency that happens to do a lot of medical marketing, or it happens to be an office admin that's just been tasked with marketing their doctor's office. You have to think, where are those people? What conversations are they engaging in? How can you meaningfully get this content in front of them? And a lot of it is going to be laying the groundwork ahead of time, going to the LinkedIn groups where, you know, they're likely to be and participating in those conversations and making relationships there. It might be Google Plus groups that are around medical subject matter in general or medical business. It could be Twitter and certain hashtags that are noticed by those particular individuals. So, you know, for each individual, not only each individual company, but each individual persona is going to have different areas that those people gravitate toward and conversate in, and really to have their own little community. And it's a matter of becoming involved in that community in a meaningful way, and not just to promote your content, but to actually add value to the group. And whether that's you sharing your content, which again comes from a point of value, or whether it's sharing someone else's content that you know the group's going to appreciate. In the end, it's all about people and value. As long as you're creating value for those people, you'll be able to bring them in. And like I said, they're creating community. So when you take one, let's say, office manager, and you've helped her with a problem that she's been having, or a better way to do something that she's been doing, she's going to know and be aware of other office managers or other medical marketers, and she's going to take it upon herself to share that in those communities. And we've seen that time and time again, not only for ourselves, but for our clients as well.
So let's talk about Twitter for a minute then. When you are, say, new to, you're exploring a new niche, for example, how do you find out which hashtags are the most popular? Are there some tools that you're using for Twitter, or is it just a crafty way of doing search to discover which hashtags are the most popular?
Sure. There's a few different ways. There definitely are tools that you can use to identify specific, or if specific keywords are being used in hashtags. We do use those from time to time, but when you're first starting out in Twitter, I always think the best thing to do is find the market leaders within that industry. Now, they may not be the market leader as far as company size or revenue or whatever metric you want to put on the company. But when I say market leader, as far as social media would be concerned, market leader within that social space. So how much engagement do they have? Are they talking to their followers? Are they building an audience? Or do they just exist in that space? So find who the leaders are, and that works for Google Plus or Facebook or any of the other social properties. So identify who those people are within that industry. Some of them may be competitors, some may be suppliers, some may be customers. And kind of sit back and watch what information is being shared, what information is being consumed, and what type of engagement levels are happening around those pieces of content. If you see that and you can see where the engagement is truly happening and who's kind of winning that engagement war, you're going to start to see a trend of what hashtags are being used around the pieces that are actually getting engaged with. But more importantly than the hashtag is the type of content that's being engaged with, because that's going to be a lot of the type of content that you're going to need to create. And hopefully you're going to be able to use that as a springboard to take it one step higher and create that much better content.
Do you ever use a tool by the name of Follower Wonk to help you with this, to find influencers in a certain niche?
What was the name of the tool?
Follower Wonk. It's from Moz.com.
I personally do not. We actually have three individuals that handle the entire social aspect. They may use that on the clients once it gets to that level. I personally do not use that, though.
Okay. It is a tool that is a great way if you're looking for, and there's a free version and a paid version, if you're looking for people who have influence on Twitter and particularly, Follower Wonk is something worth exploring, folks. Okay, so creating content, sharing content. Do you syndicate your content at all?
We do have a few places where it is syndicated. I believe we're on Business to Community. Office Depot has a blog that I believe we're syndicated on. Certain times we're syndicated on HubSpot's blog. And there are a few other smaller places that pick up pieces from time to time.
Do you know, I've not spoken with anyone who's syndicating to Office Depot's blog before. Is that producing anything for you?
It is. It is a pretty well-read blog. And the people that come from there are pretty well tuned in and pretty engaged. When they come on, many times they're not just reading, you know, one blog article. They'll actually sit and read two or three, or there was actually one person that came and we saw where they're going to a lot of different pages. And usually we assume that if somebody's doing that much activity and looking at everything, that they're not a potential customer, they're probably a competitor. But when this particular person actually got through all of the blogs, they sent an email and said, you know, we found you over here and we just love your content. We've actually read your entire blog now. Keep producing more.
did they become a client?
That particular one did not become a client. No, they were a very small startup, hopefully in the future, though.
Yeah, wow, interesting. All right. So syndicating to Office Depot, there's a new one for me. I'll have to have my team check into that. All right, let me look at the questions here. What have we not talked about so far? I know what we haven't talked about. Okay, so you get a sales qualified lead, and at some point that conversation is going to transition from the blog to social media to the phone or in person. When you're doing that very first, I call it a scoping call. You're kind of sussing mm-hmm. them out. They're sort of sussing you out. You both are trying to figure out, like, should we ever talk to each other again after this? What type of agenda do you go into that scoping call with?
I would say we have two agendas. One is to figure out, one, can we help that company? So there's a lot of companies that are just not going to be a good fit for us. And the worst thing that could happen is we get involved in a relationship where we can't bring maximum value. So the first thing we want to know is can we help them? And the second thing that we want to know is, are they going to let us help them? You know, there's a lot of companies that want to say they're doing something, just to say, oh yeah, we hired a marketing agency and they're going to fix everything. But then when you actually start coming with ideas or strategies or something of that nature, they say, oh yeah, we don't want to do that. We want to do our own idea, our own thing over here. We're not interested in what you guys think. We just want you to do whatever we want, which, again, doesn't maximize the value that we can offer. So those are the two things that we're really looking for. And there's a few different ways we get there. We ask them about the activities that they've done in the past. We ask them about the type of customers that they're going after. We ask how they're currently generating those sales opportunities and where they are revenue-wise and where they want to be. If we feel from those answers that we can add value, then we'll pursue that relationship and set up a second call where we can ask them a lot of very intricate things about the business and about their customers and figure out where we can actually add the most value. Most times, and this isn't all the time, but most times the actual marketing platform that they're using is determined to be ineffective. They don't have a clear path to conversion or a clear path to create a customer once someone has said that they're interested, and that could be interested in a blog, you know, subscribing to the blog. It could be subscribing to a webinar. It could be downloading an ebook. It could be requesting a consultation. Believe it or not, we had one customer that we uncovered that had 200 people that filled out a request a quote form that had never been addressed. Oh. They just never followed up with these 200 people. So we would uncover these particular things and then go back and say, this is our roadmap to building an adequate marketing platform for you. Directly after we have this marketing platform, we want to engage in these types of activities to maximize your benefit within that platform. And that platform will be built from start to finish with those activities in mind. So it's kind of a two-stage approach. We say, At the end of the day, these are the marketing activities we want to do, and this is the success that we believe it could achieve for you, and here is the platform that needs to support those types of activities. And that's where we found the most success, mainly because I think it's hard for people in general to intertwine the idea that your website is your you know, lead marketer or front door or digital space. They just look at it as a standalone piece. It's a brochure component that someone could go and look at, and it can be. And most of the time when our clients come to us, that's what they have. And we kind of open their eyes to that website is just one piece of the puzzle. You have a much larger marketing platform that has to be built out and perfected and gotten on message and aimed in the right direction before you can ever do generally what they would come and say is, I want blogging. Well, why are you going to do blogging? We haven't built this platform. So you blog, you attract someone, you have no way for them to convert. Mm-hmm. Let's take a step back. Let's figure out what your message is. Let's figure out the value you're adding. Let's figure out what you can offer to show these people the value that you could bring to the table. And then let's build a platform that can not only attract those people in, but get them to start engaging your company in a meaningful way. And then let's have a path to actually creating a customer out of those individuals. So 90% of the time, that's what we're looking at on a sales call is how to, one, judge where they are, two, educate, and three, offer a solution that really gets them to that next level.
And the platform that you're referring to, do you use the word platform to describe, for example, HubSpot, landing pages, workflows, emails, a couple of lead magnets, calls to action, all that stuff that is needed? So
Social media.
Yeah. So when they start
videos and also bridging the gap between online and offline. I mean, there's, you know, a lot of these companies that say, hey, good digital marketing, content marketing, inbound marketing, that's fine. We love that. But we have a 20-person sales team that literally goes out and visits with our existing customers, knocks on doors, goes to trade shows, does in-person marketing activities. How can you help support that as well? So we need to know those pieces too. What we don't want to do is have one message and value proposition online and a completely separate thing happening offline. Those on and offline components need to align. So a lot of times we'll get involved, and what I'm considering the platform definitely involves all the components that you just named. But a lot of times it'll also involve their sales presentations or their trade show booths or their sales collateral as well.
So at what point do you transition from the discovery call to them paying you to give them this advice? Because at the beginning, sales 101, you've got to ask a lot of questions to identify need. You got to make sure they have budget. You got to make sure they have authority. They got to make sure they have timeline. They're ready to go. What do you sell them first? Like, is it in our case, our agency sells them a content marketing blueprint, which is like a game plan for 90 days. And it describes in detail exactly, what everything needs to look like, how it's all connected together. And then, they can go off and do it on their own, or they can hire us to build it all for them. What's the very first, when do you guys transition from free advice to paid deliverables?
The piece you're talking about, that game plan piece, mm-hmm. We do that over a 90-day period as well, but we also intermix that with building of that platform. So we build the plan on each individual component or how they're going to interact with each other. Directly after we have approval, those things start getting slated for production. So what we found is that a lot of times if we do one standalone piece, whether it be just the game plan or just the platform or just one standalone component, it kind of gets the client in this one-off project type mindset. And what we found to be successful is to eliminate that from the beginning and just say, this is what we're doing. This is an ongoing component. You're going to need all of these things in perpetuity to be as successful as possible. So what we're going to do is produce these elements, and then as soon as they're approved, we're going to start producing them. And that really allows us to allows us to do a couple things. One, it allows them to keep what I would consider the right frame of mind as marketing is a continuing operation. That doesn't have a start and end date. And the other thing, it allows us to be basically ahead of the game at all points. So the second they say, I like that design or I like that piece of content that you're talking about there, we can start integrating or building it and integrating that into the plan. So the second, for instance, their website launches and their platform is perfected, we're not sitting there going, okay, here's this other contract now to start your marketing activities. We've already started that. We've already got, 10, 20, 30 blog articles, not only slated for production, but we've got them already written, already ready to go, already put on your blog. We already have your influencers identified on social media. We already have content ready to flow. We already have a webinar planned for you. We already have all your designs ready. We're marketing now. We're not talking about starting up marketing.
So do you normally get people to agree to be on the retainer from day one?
Yes, normally. If they're planning on pursuing a retainer-based relationship, we do start that from day one, yes.
Okay. Well, that makes sense.
One thing I do want to add to that, the majority of agencies, if you read their contracts, they have a 12-month contract. And a lot of it's because there's that build-up time. There's a time in the beginning where you're investing a lot more in that client than they're actually paying you for to try and get them ready. Mm-hmm. So a lot of agencies will do the 12 months to kind of balance that out. We don't do that. What we do is 3 months, and the reason for that is that we think at 3 months. There will be two things. One, they're going to see the actual production starting to happen. They're going to start to see results, generally speaking. It depends on the industry and competition. They're going to start to see things happening, and they're going to be happy with what they're seeing, that they won't leave on month 4, 5, or 6. And we don't feel we need to lock them in. We don't want clients that are continuing to do business with us because the contract says they have to. We want clients to keep doing business with us because we're doing a really good job for them, and they want to be our client. So, you know, although they are on a retainer from day one, basically, they're not locked in for a 12-month period of time. If they're not happy, I'm happy to report that to date that has never happened. So hopefully we continue that trend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I like that approach because it's a filter too. One of the things that has been very common in all the agency owners that I've interviewed, and it's been several dozen now, they've said, you know, early on, we accepted some of the wrong clients and it ended up being, you know, kind of a painful experience. And so now we're very, very choosy about the people that we work with. And I think that if you believe that marketing is an ongoing service, which absolutely it is, kind of like oxygen, you need to have a client that has got the mindset that they're looking for a long-term partner. And my guess is if someone is squawking at a 90-day retainer that doesn't even really have any way to force them in to keep on going, that they're going at it from the wrong, they don't have the right mindset to begin with.
Absolutely. And the other piece to add to that, you know, there are bad customers out there. Not all money is good money. And there's certain red lights that, you know, especially for people in startup situations, start noticing them. You know, take note of what types of clients in your particular industry are going to cause the problems. You know, certain things are going to be, you know, how quick or slow a particular company is to paying your invoice. If they're not paying your invoice, that's a telltale sign this is not going to be, you know, a good relationship over time. If, you know, they're trying to really dissect all of your contracts and, you know, want to take all of the clauses out of them and getting that granular on, you know, day one, it probably isn't going to be a good relationship. And it's going to be different for every industry, but, you know, those types of signs and, you know, someone not really listening to you as a consultant and just, you know, wanting to have you do what they think is best. You know, these type of things, you've got to be very vigilant and watching them and figure out. Sometimes it's just, you know, hey, our in-house counsel had a problem with this one phrase in the contract. Can we get this switched? That's perfectly fine. Other times it's, oh, hey, we want you to just completely get rid of your contract and go ahead and sign this one here that gives us basically the ability to do whatever we want. And, you know, those are crazy situations. And when you're brand new, starting up, you're liable to do that type of thing. So I just need the customer. I can guarantee you don't need those types of customer that bad enough. You would be far better off using the time that you would spend with that customer finding a better customer that is truly wanting your help, truly wanting to build a relationship, and truly wanting the benefit that you can offer with your product or services.
Mm-hmm. Sage advice, Nathan. All right, we're going to wrap up here pretty quick because we're getting close to the end. Is there anything that I have not asked you about that you think would make this interview richer for the audience?
There is one thing that you had on your list you had sent over to me, and it was what book have you read most recently? I think it was, and I have not finished this book. But if your audience in general is interested in startups and entrepreneurship and building a business from the ground up, I'm currently reading a very interesting book. It is written by the director for entrepreneurship at MIT, Bill Allweth, I believe is his name, and it's called Disciplined Entrepreneurship. And basically what he's done is he's outlined a 24-step platform that he believes will allow you to properly vet opportunities and properly build your business with the correct footing, not only from who your customer is to what your product is, to what your business model is and how it's scalable and how it will be delivered over the course of time. It's really, to me, it's very interesting to look at all of those individual components and then how they actually progress to create what you would consider the, you know, perfect business or business model. And just because it's perfect doesn't mean it's going to work. Not all ideas are good ideas. Not all businesses are good businesses, but if you have an idea and you kind of want to validate it, there's really two ways you can do it. You can go through, you know, kind of a process like this and get the groundwork and have it all written down and have a game plan from day one, or you can go out there and try and sell it and see if it works and cross your fingers and hope that it all works out for you and you're able to create a company. But in reading this book, I can tell you that the new ideas and new concepts that I'm having, I'm definitely applying these types of principles to the creation and the validation of the business itself. And we're actually working on a few side projects, a few startup companies ourselves that we're using these principles to craft the company. So definitely, if the audience is interested in entrepreneurship, pick that up. Disciplined Entrepreneurship is a great book.
I just did pick it up as you were giving that explanation. Amazon is shipping it as we speak. So thank you very much for bringing that up. And folks, if you're listening to this while you're driving, don't worry. It's all going to be in the show notes with links to everything. And I'll announce the link to the show notes here just at the very end of the episode. So stay tuned for that. All right, Nathan, for people who want to get in touch with you, what's the one easiest way for them to do that?
The easiest way to get in touch with me is probably to go to our website. You can fill out any form on our website. Contact us would be the easiest one, and they will all go to me. So I'll see anything that comes in the website, or feel free to email me at nathan@adherecreative.com.
Okay, terrific, Nathan. Thank you so much for making some time to so generously share all of the tactics and the strategies that you just did. Much appreciated.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I'm glad I could do it.
To get to the show notes for this episode, go to brightideas.co/142. And if you enjoyed this episode, please help me to spread the word about it by going to brightideas.co/love, where there is a pre-populated tweet awaiting the click of your mouse. So that's it for this episode. I am your host, Trent Dearsmid. Thank you so very much for tuning in. I look forward to having you back for another episode soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks very much for listening to the Bright Ideas Podcast. Check us out on the web at brightideas.co.
All right, show's over. I'm tired.